the award-winning Your Financial Editor program on 930 WFMD, news from the worlds of business and finance, with Your Financial Editor, Chris Murray.
This is Chris Murray, your financial editor on Free Talk Radio 930 WFMD at WFMD.com. And as a podcast, just go to the Audio Vault or go to Apple Podcasts and you can grab it there. Thanks for being with us. Hope things are going well. Looking forward to our discussion today with my guest. He's been on before, friend of the program, Mr. Robert Romano, Vice President of Public Policy at Americans for Limited Government Foundation. I had mentioned earlier in the program, put out a couple really good pieces this week, and that's why I wanted to invite him on to talk about that. And by the way, you can get the material we're talking about at no cost. They have a daily email that they put out, and also you can go to getliberty.org and grab a lot of that content there as well. And so we'll get right into this. Robert, thanks a lot for taking time out of your schedule to be with us again. I appreciate it. I mentioned the one article that really caught my attention that you penned this week. You could eliminate every federal department, agency, and fire every federal employee, including the military, and still not be able to balance the budget. How can we get our heads around that?
Well, the national debt in 2023 grew by $1.8 trillion, and the entire discretionary spending budget, that is all of the appropriations bills, things that are not Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment benefits, so-called mandatory spending, but the discretionary spending for departments and agencies totals $1.7 trillion. So you grow the debt by $1.8 trillion, but and the entire discretionary budget is $1.7 trillion. So even if you eliminated the entire federal government, the entire federal workforce, every department and agency, you still could not balance the budget because mandatory spending is growing way faster than revenues have been growing. If you go back to 1963, revenues have grown by about 6.9% a year, while mandatory spending has grown by about 8.9% a year. In the meantime, discretionary spending, Congress is actually kind of fiscally disciplined over this time. It only grew by 5.5%. If mandatory spending had only grown by 5.5%, well, heck, the budget would be balanced right now.
And what's behind the mandatory spending that, like you said, is the cause or the main cause of the problem?
Absolutely. So what you're seeing is what the aging workforce, as baby boomers are headed into or are retiring en masse and will continue to do so over the next 8 years, you are seeing Social Security spending is going to balloon to more than $2.3 trillion by 2033. Medicare will be north of $1 trillion by then, and so will Medicaid will be up to, actually, what Medicare will be up to $1.8 trillion by 2033, and Medicaid will be up to close to $1 trillion at $930 billion. The reason for that is because the percentage of the population over the age of 65 since 1960 has increased from 16% to 26%. And obviously the reason for that is just simply declining fertility. You've seen the fertility go from 3.6 babies per woman back in 1960 when FDA approved birth control down to less than 2 babies per woman almost immediately. And certainly it's been below 2 babies per woman since 2008 financial crisis. It hit a record low in 2020, which is to say it was even lower in 2020 than it was in the 1970s. After birth control was approved, but you're only coming in at about 1.8 babies per woman at the moment. If you look at countries like South Korea, where it's declined below 1 baby per woman, I think you can kind of see what the problem here is. We're simply not reproducing at a fast enough rate to pay for our entitlements because there's simply not enough taxpayers. This probably also advises why members of Congress are so desperate to allow millions of illegal immigrants into the country every year.
So that's part of it, as you're saying, is that because we don't have the replenishment here in the United States, say, per woman, then they're often looking to the illegal immigrants or and legal immigrants to come in and actually play a role in that.
I think that's exactly what's going on. And then but George W. Bush was fond of talking about the worker to retiree ratio. He was also looking to do his own brand of amnesty, I think, towards the end of his presidency. And so what we've noted repeatedly is that politicians, members of Congress, presidents are more comfortable talking about importing cheap labor than they are to have an uncomfortable potential conversation with single women about the reproduction rate in this country.
So what do you think that is? I mean, again, I know I have young children. You know, they're all in their early to middle 20s. And, you know, it's hard. I mean, they've got great jobs. They're working really hard. You know, they're making progress. But, you know, you always get a sense that because of high inflation, because of the high cost of living, you know, fill in the blank, two incomes needed as opposed to one often just to, you know, to maintain things. Is that what's behind this lack of reproduction and, you know, one of the core issues of our debt problems?
I think in the when you get to the 1980s, in the 70s, that was probably definitely the case, because in the 1980s, you managed to get back above two babies per woman once the inflation came down from the great inflation of the 1970s. However, after the financial crisis, when you had a big unemployment problem and then people were, you're kind of coming out of that, you get to the Obama years and the Trump years, fertility was still dropping like a stone, even though economic conditions had improved dramatically following the financial crisis. So I believe that there is more to the issue now than just merely economic conditions that say, don't get married, don't have children. I think another a huge factor, obviously, is the amount of women going to college. I think if you look at white females, it would be close to 70% of all women who are still alive in the working age population have gone to college. And so what happens is you delay marriage. You also delay having children in pursuit of a career goal. And so you either have fewer children or no children at all as a result of that. And there's also about an 8 million gap between the amount of women who have gone to college versus the amount of men who have gone to college. So men don't go to college at the same high rate as women do. And as a result, you know, that's probably 8 million potential marriages that just never happened because people never met their future spouses at college. I would just note that politically, Democrats have a high incentive for females to go to college because the women who go to college tend to vote Democrat much at higher rates. And Republicans have a great incentive for both men and women not to go to college because those voters tend to vote Republican at much higher rates. So there's actually a political incentives in place for there to be very, very low fertility, much more polarization between Republicans and Democrats, men and women. The national divorce, such as it is already taking place. It's between men and women.
So I know some interesting things have happened in other countries, like Hungary, for example, where it's actually there's incentives and encouragement and benefits for the traditional family of yesteryear to kind of renew itself, and how it's been helpful to the country. And it's interesting to kind of watch that as it plays out. Is that something you think that would ever be considered here in the United States, based on your research and analysis, that we would go that way?
I know former President Donald Trump is proposing so-called baby bucks. So I think he has a policy already in the works, should he be elected again this year, to provide incentives. It sounds like he's leaning towards a tax credit, although no reports on how large that might be. or what would be necessary in order to basically to, you know, to actually incentivize the process. I think that that's going to be a big problem, is how do you actually, what is enough money to actually encourage people to both get married and have children? If you look at Hungary right now, for example, their fertility rate is well below two babies per woman. So it's unclear whether the level that they've chosen, it's about 1.6 or something like that. That's far, you know, that's below replacement population. And so that's going to be a problem for them, I think, going forward. And so, I mean, I've done some back of the envelope calculations. For example, if you did 20,000 upfront for new babies in the United States, regardless of marriage status, and then 5,000 every year thereafter, after about 20 or once the babies that were produced got into the labor force and they themselves started paying taxes, eventually the program would pay for itself. You could aim pretty high, and do massive tax credits, and that ultimately it would end up paying for itself because the people who were created ended up working at whatever 70% rate, and then ended up going, you know, and then end up paying taxes, and then they'll do that over an entire lifetime, and that will actually raise more revenue than it would cost up front to do the tax credit.
Yeah, so, and that's really interesting, and it makes sense, you know, when you say it. Do you think that the general public would understand that and be able to embrace it? I mean, like you said, it would work out if you could prove mathematically that it is going to work out with, you know, reasonable expectations, not pie in the sky. You think if it was presented right, people would, you know, like I said, understand that and actually vote for those types of things?
No, because I find that conservative Republicans in Congress particularly are incapable of voting even for appropriations bills that both cut spending and limit regulations. The votes aren't there to pass these types of legislation. And we know that congressional Democrats would obviously never go for such a policy, even if it meant that there was massive child care. It would be a massive child care tax credit. I just hypothetically put something out there that's $40,000 per baby, regardless of marriage status, on the basis that, well, about 70% of them are going to end up working.
Yeah.
And so eventually they're going to get there. So I think even, I mean, maybe they would go for it. I don't know. It's possible, but it would require a dramatic reshaping of how we talk about these issues. Again, in the entire discussion about Social Security, when have you ever heard anyone point to declining fertility?
Yeah, no.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
That's the root cause. It's the obvious, easy cause, in fact. It's the most easy to prove cause. But no one brings it up. It's like, oh, well, gee, there's just a smaller worker to retiree ratio. Why is that?
Right. So, I mean, you know, everybody talks about Social Security as the third rail and don't touch it, don't talk about it. But, I mean, we do on purpose because we want to make sure that people are aware that, you know, there is going to come a day of reckoning. And we are reminded of that every year by the trustees who put out the letter and tell us, okay, this is when it becomes insolvent, whether it's Social Security or Medicare or whatever. So, again, because it's used pushing, you know, the grandmother off the cliff in the wheelchair and all that nonsense, that you have to wonder what type of person would believe that without looking into it. You said we could eliminate the federal, every federal department, agency, fire every federal employee, including the military, still not balance the budget. So obviously something has to be done with mandatory spending. What's the move on that?
Obviously attempts to cut mandatory spending when 26% of the population as of right now is over the age of 65, and that's going to rise. It's going to get closer to like 30% within the decade as you reach the so-called day of reckoning, when only 80% of benefits will be able to be paid out to a massive voting bloc. You could obviously try to address this ahead of time. And say, well, you know, I mean, woe unto the incumbent party that's in power once they have to start cutting benefits, or then they start going in and saying, we need to raise taxes on everyone making over $170,000 or whatever, or over $250,000. We're going to just increase their payroll taxes and suck another $10,000 out of their purses every single year. And they'll say, well, gee, you know, we need to raise taxes to pay for this. So you're either going to have massive tax increases, or you're going to see pretty substantial benefit cuts, or you're just going to take it all out of the general fund and just borrow the money. I guess those are your three options, or some combination thereof, in order to make 100% of benefits, Social Security, Medicare, et cetera, to go out. But suffice to say, that's, you know, we have a catastrophic fiscal situation. OMB is projecting that the national debt will grow to about $50 trillion by 2033. By my own calculations, however, once you factor in recessions and wars, the national debt's been growing by 8% a year since 1980. So it'll be more like $69 trillion by 2033, and more like $100 trillion by, say, 2037 or so. And so that's going to be well north of 200% debt to GDP. And who's going to buy all these treasuries? U.S. financial institutions are going to have to buy all these treasuries. Well, heaven forbid the interest rates ever go up, like you have a, you know, you might get a recession and then interest rates go down. Everyone buys treasuries and then interest rates go up because we have such catastrophic levels of debt coming forward. I think we have to address this demographic situation that we are in. We cannot afford to import the third world, and we must have an honest discussion between men and women as a nation about what we're doing to basically commit demographic suicide over careerism of all things, over equity of all things. Well, there's no equity if there's no people.
Yeah, yeah, it's so hard to hear, and we purposely bring up these things constantly because even though it's hard to hear, we need to hear it. And we need to be as informed as possible and to understand, you know, basically what the end game is. And it's just not looking good at all right now. I mean, basically, it seems like somebody has to in power has to decide to, you know, fall on not just one sword, but I think two right now. One is the border and two is the spending issue and how we're going to fiscally, you know, continue to be a successful country.
These are very big problems that we face. That's why you have a constitution. That's why you have elected members of Congress. And that's why you have an elected president. I think going forward, it's going to take incredible leadership, I believe, to address these issues. And more than a little bit of honesty about this, we dance around these problems. The Congress will wait until you're cutting benefits
right
on senior citizens and the trust funds are being depleted rapidly before they say, oh, we should do something. That's too late. We must address this right now. But even when you had the debt ceiling deal in 2023, which resulted in sequestration, we've had two. This will be the second sequestration on April 30. Sequestration is going to go back into effect. Presuming they don't pass all of the appropriations bills, they never do. So it'll be April 30. You get the sequestration again. Both the sequestrations in 2011 and in 2023 will be successful. They will further press down or freeze discretionary spending levels below the rate of increase for revenues. Revenues will grow faster than discretionary spending. But nothing at all was done to address the mandatory spending side of the equation, because everyone always tries to insert poison pills into anything that might address either border legislation or something to do with Social Security and Medicare. And again, they'll do anything except have an uncomfortable discussion with the single woman voting bloc.
Yeah,
about having children. We need children. We need more people.
No, you're
this
right.
It's not working, guys.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point and not heard very often. So we appreciate you pointing that out, and that way we can process it ourselves and think about it and understand. Yeah, that's a very reasonable and honest conclusion that, you know, something has to change. Otherwise, we're in real serious trouble. Our guest today has been Mr. Robert Romano. He's the Vice President of Public Policy at Americans for Limited Government Foundation. Go to Get Liberty, www.ncbi.org. Sign up for their newsletter. They've got merch. They've got all kinds of great free articles. You can get involved with them. Yeah, again, Robert, I appreciate you taking the time. You know, I like talking to you a couple few times a year and you giving us your perspective on things. So thank you for your time and for all the work that you're doing.
No problem, Chris. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Enjoy your weekend. And again, it's a little bit of a bummer, isn't it, when we talk about truth and, you know, we say focus on the facts and look behind the curtain and realize that we've got really, really serious things going on. And for those of us that are, committed to the country, love the country, love where we came from, love how God made us and stood by us. There's a lot of things we need to work on. And of course, the main thing we can do is get involved and also with our votes, right? To really understand the people that we're voting for. I don't know about you, but I am sick and tired of thinking I know a politician and what they really stand for, and then looking at their voting record, and then that very next day seeing them on TV or hearing them on the radio talking about things that are opposite of what they actually voted for. I'm sick of it, the double speak. So we'll stay on top of it. We'll continue to get you all this good information so that you are informed, educated, and can make good decisions. And that does it for us. We're up against a hard break again. I appreciate Robert Romano coming on. Go to getliberty.org. A lot of good stuff there. You get their daily emails. I enjoy them, along with a lot of other information from the guests that come on the program. And I will talk with you on the Morning News Express with Bob Miller and Chris Williams. And then we'll be back here next Saturday for another edition of the Your Financial Editor program. This is Chris Murray wishing you and your family financial success.
American girls and American guys, we'll always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see old glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our head. My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. Soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July.
NZ Kramer & Son and WFRE would like to thank the Greater Frederick community for their tremendous support during our 2024 St. Jude Radiothon. With your help, we raised over $610,000 for the kids at St. Jude. Your generosity is so appreciated. Since 1890, NZ Kramer & Son has been offering sales and service of plumbing, electrical, lumber, and other home improvement supplies to local customers, both residential and commercial. For a complete list of products and services, visit nzkramer.com.
Fraudulent tax returns due identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Their U.S.-based restoration specialists are dedicated to helping solve identity theft issues, and all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, which means if you lose money because of identity theft, LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan. Help protect your information with LifeLock. Go to LifeLock.com and save up to 25% your first year with my name, Clay, as your promo code.
Get the luck of the stylish and save at Regency Furniture. Pick up your lucky scratch-off card, then scratch away and save 10, 15, even an extra 20% off your purchase. Plus, no interest financing. Get the luck of the stylish and save at Regency Furniture. Shop in-store and online.
This is 930 WFMD and WFMD.com. Now, WFMD News.
Maryland State Police are continuing their investigation of several vehicle crashes in Frederick County early Friday morning on Interstate 70 involving escaped horses, which injured a trooper. Just before 3 a.m., troopers were dispatched to I-70 at mile marker 62 in Newmarket for horses in the roadway. They learned that two horses escaped from their enclosures and were struck by multiple vehicles on I-70, including a tractor-trailer and two passenger cars. The horses died as a result. Authorities say a trooper was in his cruiser at the time with its emergency lights flashing when it was struck by a vehicle heading westbound. The driver of the striking vehicle remained at the scene. The trooper and the drivers of the two passenger cars were transported to Frederick Health Hospital by ambulance, where they were treated for their injuries. State police say all lanes of I-70 were closed briefly while troopers conducted their investigation. Online casino gambling could be coming to Maryland if a bill in the General Assembly is passed and voters approve it in a referendum. The legislation would allow the state's six casinos to work with online gaming operators to provide this service. Supporters say it would bring in millions of dollars to the state, but Frederick County Delegate April Miller has some concerns.
We already have a lot of issues with the sports, gaming and the sports betting right now, and that's really new for us here. So I'd like to get some of those worked on before we add in iGaming.
Miller says she also is concerned about problem gambling. The bill has a requirement that a fund be set up to assist problem gamblers. If passed, voters would decide in a referendum in November whether they want online gaming in Maryland. I'm Kevin McManus on Mid-Maryland's Radio News Center, 930 WFMD.
Fox News, I'm Paul Stevens. Boeing under investigation again.
United Airlines says a Boeing 737 airplane landed in Oregon missing an external panel. The flight left San Francisco and landed safely Friday at Medford Airport, but once they got there, crews discovered the panel was gone. Luckily, no passengers were hurt, but this is the latest in a series of mid-flight incidents that have raised questions about Boeing's aircraft safety record.
Fox's Ashley Strohmeyer. Law enforcement officers in Florida recently stopping a boat carrying 25 Haitian migrants. Governor Ron DeSantis saying migrants are not going to be allowed to enter the U.S. illegally through Florida during the current unrest in Haiti.
People know if you take that journey, you're going to get stopped and you're going to end up back where you started. So it's not worth it.
Governor DeSantis on Fox's Hannity. America's listening to Fox News.
WFMD sky scan forecast for Frederick and surrounding counties. As we head into the day, sunny with a high near 63 and northwest winds 5 to 9 miles per hour. Saturday night, partly cloudy with a low around 44 and light southwest wind. Sunday, sunny with a high near 61 and west winds 8 to 16 miles per hour with gusts as high as 21 miles per hour. Sunday night, cloudy with a low around 37. PJ's Roofing. When it comes to your roof, they've got you covered. Visit pjsroofing.com. I'm Dan Sutton.
930 WFMD with a Fox Sports update.
From the Fox Sports studios in Los Angeles, here's Kevin Figures.
With Selection Sunday a day away, Friday night was stacked with college basketball conference tournament matchups. In the Mountain West in Las Vegas, New Mexico defeated Colorado State 74-61. They advanced to the championship game to take on San Diego State as the Aztecs pulled away from Utah State earlier in the night. NC State banked in a three-pointer to force overtime and then picked up a 73-65 victory over Virginia. They will face North Carolina for the ACC title. Upset victories for Colorado and Oregon. They will square off for the Pac-12 championship. Wins in the SEC for Florida, Texas A&M, Mississippi State, and Auburn. In the Big 12, Iowa beat Baylor 76-62. In NFL news, free agent All-Pro offensive tackle Tyron Smith has agreed to terms with the Jets on a one-year contract. The Rams will sign quarterback Jimmy Garoppolo to a one-year deal.
Take a pause.
Canada geese always look so majestic in the sky, but when they get to the ground,
just one Canada goose can create up to 1.5 pounds of feces per day. And as a result, that quickly multiplies when you get 10 or 100 Canada geese.
Doug Winsink of the Ohio Department of Natural Resources says the Migratory Bird Treaty Act means no matter what kind of mess they make, do not mess with Canada geese.
They are federally protected, and this act prohibits any kind of unlawful taking of these birds, whether it's physically injuring them, killing them.
Their breeding season is coming up, and the Humane Society of the U.S. says to cut the population, communities should replace their real eggs with fakes. And Canada geese are so unpopular, there are dozens of nicknames for them, like Cobra Chicken, Military-Grade Seagull, Canadian Jerk, and the Honking Death. Take pause. Jill Nato, Fox News.
Today's Frederick County Sports Weekend program was recorded at an earlier date.
It's your financial editor with Chris Murray on 930 WFMD.
Feeling better now that we're through. Feeling better 'cause I'm over you. I learned my lesson, he left a scar. Now I see how you really are. You're no good, you're no good, you're no good. Baby, you're no good.
Turn it up.
Welcome back. This is Chris Murray, your financial editor on Free Talk Radio 930 WFMD at WFMD.com. And as a podcast, just go to Apple Podcasts and you can grab this program. Last week, a couple weeks ago, Dr. Carson was on. That's always good speaking with him. But, you know, they go way back. So if you want to re-listen to a program, help yourself. Very glad to have with us today Mr. Stephen Bradbury. Mr. Bradbury served in the Trump administration as the Senate confirmed general counsel of the U.S. Department of Transportation. He was there from November 17 until January 21, and he was basically the department's chief legal officer, and he was also in the Bush 43 administration, and he got his... Oh, you know what else is really good that I saw on his resume that might... you know, get his opinion on. He actually clerked for Justice Clarence Thomas of the Supreme, or you know, on the Supreme Court. So, what a wonderful man and American patriot there. But he got his law degree from Michigan Law School and his bachelor's degree from Stanford. And really glad to have Mr. Bradbury on the program. Hello, Mr. Bradbury. How are you today?
Hey, Chris. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thanks for taking the time. I know you're a busy man and getting a lot of good stuff done. I had mentioned to you off the air before we came on, you know, we're recognizing the basically the one-year anniversary of what happened in East Palestine, Ohio, with the train derailment and just the horrific consequences right there. Since you were at the Department of Transportation, could you kind of help our listeners visualize and understand better, you know, what happened there and how it should have been handled?
Sure. Thanks, Chris. You know, this is a horrible conflagration, obviously. Dangerous chemicals, vinyl chloride principally, leaking out, and just horrible for the citizens of that community. And it almost seems like the administration basically wanted to turn its back on the people in communities like East Palestine, which are too often forgotten in our political policy debates and what have you. And I think what should have happened is that a senior officer from the administration, I probably would have tagged Secretary Buttigieg with this responsibility, if not the president himself, should have been on the ground within a day of that disaster and should have been coordinating all government efforts, federal, state, and local, and all responses to the tragedy, and communicating clearly to the local citizens what was going on, why things were happening, what the risk levels were. And that flow of information, I think, would have been so precious to the people of East Palestine just in in giving them comfort to understand what was happening. And then, of course, to address the issues, explain it. It seems like it was an overheated bearing in the wheels of one of the train cars, and something that could have been prevented if sensors on the track had picked it up. And the railroad has basically acknowledged that. They're obviously paying huge amounts of money to respond and to clean up, and all of that is justifiably on the railroad. But the railroad needs to be held to account, and I think the proper way to do that would be for the Department of Transportation to ensure that every major railroad in the country that carries these hazardous chemicals has a safety plan in place that will ensure that these kinds of preventable derailments do not happen, and that when they do happen, there's a stringent liability on the railroads. I don't think it's necessarily a matter of requiring highly prescriptive new regulations. I know there's a lot of debate about that. That can have its that can backfire if the regulations are too prescriptive and they don't take account of innovations in technology. So that's a balance. But the major thing is, you know, a face, a voice on the ground, coordinating, communicating, and responding to the needs of the citizens of East Palestine.
Yeah, and that makes total sense that's the way it should have been handled. And unfortunately for the residents, first and foremost, it just seems like it wasn't. And then you hear the interviews from the folks that live there on the ground and the horror stories. It's really, really terrible. The other thing that I found interesting, and you know, maybe you can help clear this up, is there seemed to be a string at that point in time of railroad accidents or derailments, yeah, or whatever you want to call it. Is that what it was, or is that, like, is it more typical and we just don't normally hear about those?
I think it's pretty typical, unfortunately, and we don't always hear about them. There are more than 300 derailments of freight railroads in the country every year, typically, and a lot of them, you know, very few are the kind of visual conflagration that you saw at East Palestine with the burn-off of the vinyl chloride. Just a horrendous sight, obviously. But many of them do involve contamination of groundwater, contamination of soil, river streams, etc. Most of them are relatively minor, grade crossing-related issues or switching issues in train yards, etc. But there are too many derailments, and it is a systemic problem that needs to be addressed in a comprehensive way.
Well, thank you for that explanation and also for those statistics. I'm sure that our listening audience appreciates that and is educated and enlightened. So if you will, I saw your piece this week, and I would just like you to kind of let our listeners know about the latest legal memo that you penned on the 13th and what it's all about.
Yeah, this is another in a series of memos I've done highlighting what the California climate regulators are attempting to do in terms of transforming really every mode of surface transportation in America. Most people probably know that Gavin Newsom and his climate regulators in California are trying to force the auto industry to transition to electric vehicles faster than market demand would support in order to address concerns about global warming. I don't know what gives California the license to regulate our entire auto industry to address a global climate issue, but that's the mandate they've taken on. And number two, they've done it with railroads, locomotives, and I wrote a long piece on what they're trying to do in terms of transforming the railroad industry across the country, and now they're taking on trucks, and this has to do with the trucking industry. So it's a two-pronged effort by them. They're going after the manufacturers of the big, heavy truck rigs to force them to transition to selling electric trucks, which, by the way, haven't been proven reliable. They don't perform the same work They don't have the same utility as diesel trucks, so the cost is going to be very high. They're very expensive as well. But now in this new set of rules, California is going after the trucking companies and the truckers, and they're trying to force the trucking companies to shift to transition to electric trucks. So they're going to require them to buy only electric trucks going forward, and to ensure that they meet certain benchmarks in terms of how many electric trucks in their fleet. So they have to get to 100% by late 2030s or mid 2040s, depending on the size of the truck. And this is going to apply to large entities that are trucking firms, medium-sized to larger trucking companies and truck rental companies. Anywhere in the country, as long as they have one truck operating in California at any point during the year, they're going to be subject to this rule. Ostensibly, the rule only applies to their truck fleets in California. But if you know the industry, a lot of these bigger trucking companies and truck rental firms, they don't know when one of their trucks is going to need to go into California or not. So it's going to put pressure on their whole network and their whole fleet. And this is just going to drive the costs of shipping up for everybody in the country. It's going to worsen the supply chain issues, the bottlenecks with the ports in California, et cetera. And it's really an example of a sort of green dream regulatory, your eyes are bigger than it's aspirational. And it's unrealistic, but these coercive mandates are being imposed. And the federal government, the Biden administration, is allowing California to run with these regulations. And, there's a lot of argument that that's an improper exercise of the EPA's authority under the Federal Clean Air Act. There are a lot of issues raised, legal issues, about whether this is lawful. Because Congress has said for interstate trucking, interstate railroads, we want to have standardized federal regulations. We don't want the states to impose 50 different sets of standards. But here we have California imposing standards on the trucking industry, which is really going to affect their costs, their prices, the services they can offer. And that affects every single American because we're so highly dependent on the truckers, the motor carriers, to carry our goods in this country. And we need economical trucking to keep those goods affordable. But California is trying to change the entire industry. And they're getting away with it. We'll see if the courts stop them. That's about the only hope, unless there's a major change in policy in Washington.
Yeah. And, I remind people, if you have something, a trucker brought it to you, whether That's it was right. loaded, the sea containers at port, or if it's on the railroad, but one way or the other, it's going to get on a truck and it's going to be delivered to you. And like you said, the horrific part of that is the additional cost that will be passed on to the consumer. That's right. And of course, we know it will hurt the poor, those on fixed incomes, the single moms. It's going to hurt all them the most, and we know that. We're not making it up, or I'm not making it up. I mean, we see it with this inflation the last few years. It's just devastating with the credit card debt just for necessities, and the auto delinquencies and all the different things that we talk about constantly here on the program. It's really scary stuff. Our guest today, Mr. Stephen Bradbury, served in the Trump administration as a Senate confirmed general counsel of the U.S. Department of Transportation. Also was in the Bush 43 administration and clerked for Justice Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court. What a wonderful American he is. I'm sure, Mr. Bradbury, that was a privilege.
Oh, absolutely. One of the greatest years of my life. And actually, it continues because he's so close with the entire extended clerkship family, spouses and children, and in some cases, grandchildren now. He's been on the court 32 years. God bless him. It's just a very close relationship that all of us who clerked with him continue to have with the justice. So it's a great privilege.
I'm sure it is a privilege and a wonderful experience. So let's get back to your article, because to me, this, it begs the question, we're talking about a tractor trailer here, and right away I go to how much lithium, cobalt, fill in the blank, material mining is going to have to be done to create a battery that is proficient enough for interstate commerce.
That's right. I mean, these batteries are huge in these tractor trailer rigs, you know, the electric, new electric versions of these. And many of the, you know, battery components, the processed minerals and whatnot, are made in China. And China uses coal-fired power to generate the electricity for those operations. And the amount of carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere that goes into the manufacture of these batteries is the equivalent of driving a diesel-powered truck for some years. So it's really it's really not accurate to suggest that these trucks are zero emission. They may be zero emission while operating, but there's a lot of emissions that go into the manufacture of the battery. And then, of course, the battery is really heavy. So the electric trucks are 25 or 30% heavier than diesel-powered trucks. And what that means is, as you probably know, if you know trucking, there's a gross weight rating. Any truck can only carry so much total weight. That includes the weight of the truck. So if the truck starts out 25 or 30% heavier, well, that means that truck can only can carry 25 or 30% less total cargo, and which translates into 25 or 30% higher operating costs for the trucking operator, the motor carrier. And so if you think about, you mentioned the ports in California, you know, they have three of the biggest ports in the country. All the biggest Pacific Coast ports for our nation are in California. All that cargo coming through those ports is dependent on those drayage trucks, those tractor trailers that take those cargo containers from the ports. The California rule requires those drayage truck operators to convert to electric or hydrogen fuel cell trucks. Much more expensive. They have much more limited range. They carry less cargo, as I just described. And the infrastructure for charging isn't there. So what's going to happen is the costs of those trucking companies are going to go way up. A lot of them, some of them are going to go out of business. And if you just think about the supply chain bottleneck in those ports, we all remember the thousands of ships waiting offshore to come into those ports. It's all dependent on how much capacity you have to move those containers out of the ports with those trucks. And if just 10% of the drayage truck operators go out of business, that's 10% less capacity coming through those ports. And that will hit everybody in the country. Because even out here in Maryland, we're dependent on goods coming in from Asia through those California ports. So the implications, the effects of this will ripple across the country and will affect the entire economy.
Yeah, and when you talked about a moment ago, you mentioned the ship backup. You were referring to what we saw live when the virus came and we had problems at the port, and we had all those ships out there waiting to be offloaded, right?
That's right. Any capacity issue at those ports causes a backup. It could be a labor issue. It could be, limitations on the numbers of workers at the port. Some machinery goes down, whatever. But also these trucks. The trucks carry the containers to the intermodal rail facilities or to the rest of the country. And those trucks are streaming in and out. We're talking about Long Beach, L.A. Port, and Oakland Port in California. And if you put restrictions that drive up the costs for those trucking carriers and put some of them out of business, you're just worsening the bottleneck issues at those ports. And that's a national issue. That's something Congress should look at. It's something that the federal government should manage and not a single state, and this is a single state that's imposing these regulations for climate change purposes. You know, this is highly debatable. What is California's role? Climate change doesn't affect California any differently than affects the rest of the world, and trucks operating in California don't affect the global climate any differently than a truck operating in Maryland or any place else. And so what gives California the right to impose its green dream aspirational regulatory requirements on the rest of the country? That's a major question, and it's a big problem now when California's in this climate regulation business and trying to change really every industry it can possibly target, certainly in the transportation sector.
Yeah, it is a shame, and like you said, it's the end consumer. Well, and the businesses too. They're all just going to get hammered. You know, unfortunately,
yeah.
So many good businesses and so many good people that rely on the trucking industry, and they're going to have to pay a higher cost for no, in my opinion, no reason. It just doesn't make any sense. It hurts the most vulnerable, I think, worse than anybody else. So, Mr. Bradbury, what's the best way for people to get this memo you did, as well as you did a really nice piece, a commentary piece titled Virginia Should Make Its Own Decisions About EVs, but where do they get your work?
So I am a distinguished fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And so if you go to heritage.org and you look me up under the staff there, and when you go to my website, my bio website, everything I've written for Heritage is right there. That's probably the easiest way to get everything we've talked about today.
Yep, heritage.org, and the last name is Bradbury, Bradbury, and it is great. He even talks about how to fix the FBI. You'll see all of his wonderful writing. And we know that Heritage Foundation is a good friend of the program and has been for many, many years. So we appreciate you, Mr. Bradbury, all the work, and for really informing us and educating us today on this issue.
Terrific. Very happy to be here, Chris. Thank you so
yes,
much.
Yes, sir. You have a great weekend, and that does it for us. We're up against a hard break, and I will talk to you on the Morning News Express with Bob Miller and Chris Williams. That's at 5:50, 6:50, 7:50 a.m. every weekday morning. We have live conversations, and then we'll be back here next Saturday for another program of the Your Financial Editor Show. Thanks so much for being with us, and this is Chris Murray wishing you and your family financial success.